From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump took to Twitter today to ask what? They don't get sarcasm? This was after he was roundly criticized for the false claim that President Obama founded ISIS. Also this week, Democratic nominee Hillary Clinton had to deal with more questions about a cozy relationship between her family foundation and her State Department. Oh, and there were two big economic speeches. Our jingle guys listened. Did anyone else? Let's get to it.
Here and now, 2016.
Those guys just love watching economic speeches. It's just all they do. Joining us today is ABC's Rick Klein. Hi, Rick.
I love those speeches, too.
I do, too. And CNN's Juana Summers. Hi, Juana.
Hey, guys. How's it going?
So I want to start with some of the poll numbers that just came out today from the Wall Street Journal, NBC Marist, that show Hillary Clinton's lead over Trump increasing in key battleground states. She's leading by now 14 points, according to this poll, in Colorado, 13 in Virginia, 9 in North Carolina. She's also leading in Florida. Rick, to you, she's not just leading in these battleground states post-convention, post the cons and everything else. She's also starting to pull in some red states like Georgia and Arizona into the battleground column.
And Utah as well. And what's going on now is a collapse in the electoral coalition for Donald Trump. It doesn't mean he can't turn it around, but this is prompting something of a freakout in Republican circles. They're watching the map expand in exactly the wrong direction. Keep in mind, all that Hillary Clinton needs to do is hold the Obama states. It's Donald Trump that needs to be on offense. So the fact that we're sitting here a couple weeks after the conventions and with Labor Day looming and the map is expanding in favor of the Democrats, troublesome to say the least. And it does track the national numbers where we've seen Donald Trump's support top off and begin to drop off, especially in these critical battlegrounds.
Yeah, but Juana Summers, I mean, Rick, you used the word collapse. Even the DNC is saying, wait, don't get complacent, because Donald Trump has a way of bouncing back and he has followers who are very angry.
That's absolutely correct, Robin. I think that is that Democrats are probably wanting to make sure that there's a wait and see moment because we have seen these poll numbers be so fluctual. It's also very – I mean, we have, what, roughly maybe 90, 80 days until the election. So
87,
quite a lot
to
of
be
time
exact,
for things to change up here in Donald Trump's favor.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, let's take a look at Donald Trump's claims this week. Let's review them, shall we? At a rally in Florida on Wednesday, he called President Obama the founder of ISIS.
ISIS is honoring President Obama. He is the founder of ISIS. He's the founder of ISIS. Okay? He's the founder. He founded ISIS. And I would say the co-founder would be crooked Hillary Clinton.
Well, then yesterday, conservative radio host Hugh Hewitt tried to give Trump an out. Let's listen.
I know what you meant. You meant that he created the vacuum. He lost the peace.
No, I meant he's the founder of ISIS. I do. He's the most valuable player. I give him the most valuable player award. I give her, too, by the way.
But he's not sympathetic to them. He hates them. He's trying to kill them.
He was the founder.
Well, this morning, Trump tried to walk that back. He tweeted, ratings challenged CNN, which took this up this morning, reports so seriously that I call President Obama and Clinton the founder of ISIS. They don't get sarcasm. Rick, start with you. Last night, The Daily Show's Trevor Noah said he could picture ISIS fighters turning to their leader and saying, hey, you said you founded ISIS. And so, you know, people are taking a comical look at this. But do these, you know, making claims, walking back, do they have a serious impact?
Well, there's a pattern here. It's not just once. It's happened twice just this week with the Second Amendment comments as well. It's happened on Russian hacking. It's happened time and again. You see, he says something outrageous and then his aides kind of clarify it, and then they blame the press. I saw Senator Chris Murphy from Connecticut today. What I'm looking for, a president who has a good sense of humor about ISIS assassinations and Russian cyber warfare. These aren't comical matters, and it does have a cumulative impact. And again, you don't take any of these in a vacuum. Everyone has flubs. Everyone has missteps. But, I mean, you just played it out. It's hard to argue that when you're given the opportunity to walk something back and you don't, come back the next day and say the media is blowing it out of proportion and he's being sarcastic. It just doesn't add up.
Yeah.
I want to ask about the substance this week. Let's move on from the scandal to the substance. There were two economic speeches. We brought both of them to listeners live. And I want to start here with Donald Trump speaking about the economy in Detroit on Tuesday.
If sent to the Oval Office, Hillary Clinton will enact the TPP
as sure as you're sitting there. Her donors will make sure of it. A vote for Hillary Clinton is a vote for TPP, and it's also a vote for NAFTA.
And then in her speech in Michigan yesterday, Hillary Clinton said she's against the TPP.
I will stop any trade deal that kills jobs or holds down wages, including the Trans-Pacific Partnership. I oppose it now, I'll oppose it after the election, and I'll oppose it as president.
Juana Summers, first of all, how big of a deal is trade going to be in this campaign and in this election? And secondly, do people believe Hillary Clinton when she says that she's going to oppose TPP since she was originally for it and President Obama is also for it?
Right. Trade is going to be a huge issue in this election, particularly in states like Michigan, where both Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton gave those respective speeches we just heard. Hillary Clinton in particular spoke in the county that literally coined the term Reagan Democrats. And those are the kind of voters that Trump hopes he can flip to his side because he's focused on things like trade, like making an enemy out of China, and that Hillary Clinton's hoping she can keep to her side. As for the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal, or TPP, that you mentioned, I do think there is a bit of an authenticity question here, particularly when you're talking about a candidate. And this is true a little bit of Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. They both have deep unfavorables. Hillary Clinton has had a low percentage of voters who say they view her as honest and trustworthy. And in the past, this is something that she's kind of changed her mind on, something that Bernie Sanders pointed out during the primary. So I think this is certainly a vulnerable position for her. And I think that's why you heard her say strongly and repeatedly that she opposes TPP now. She will continue to oppose it, and she will oppose it in the White House. So really tripling down on this position in that speech.
But you mentioned the trustworthy issue, and this week some old State Department emails were released. They show the Clinton Family Foundation making requests of State Department aides, things like, can you hook up this donor with this diplomat? Now, Clinton's detractors, Rick, already think that she and Bill Clinton don't play by the rules. You know, Trump calls Hillary Clinton crooked. But, you know, do these things matter outside those really hard and fast faithful who already have their belief about Hillary Clinton?
We hear about campaigns to the bottom, but this campaign, more than anything else, is going to be an anti-campaign on both sides. And the way that it's going to be waged is to try to drive up the negatives and drive up your own turnout that way. So that's where this matters, is that it just adds up to a sense of frustration, not just around the Clintons, but around the whole political establishment. The system is rigged. You can't read these emails and not feel a little bit icky, even if you're a Clinton supporter, about the intermingling of private and public business at the State Department and the Clinton Foundation. And that, I think, on balance, is helpful to Donald Trump and is helpful to him because he makes an argument that it's time for the radical change. This is the problem with insiders. This is what the political insider class does when they have power. So, again, you're not going to change perceptions around so many people and suddenly turn around the vast majority of the public that doesn't like or trust Hillary Clinton, but you can cake in perceptions and maybe drive up turnout.
Well, you know, you mentioned the system is rigged phrase, which Donald Trump has been using. I want to ask you both, start with you, Juana. There's been a lot of speculation that Donald Trump is looking for an exit, that he is saying things like the system is rigged so that if he loses, there's that, but that gins up his following to, you know, feel that it was rigged, or if he wants to step out because he feels it's rigged. And what are you hearing?
So I think it was really interesting and very telling what we heard from Trump speaking to CNBC this week. He said, actually, you know, if things don't go his way, he's going to take a long vacation. And a nominee of a major party kind of suggesting at this state in the race that he might well lose is kind of unprecedented. What we're hearing at CNN from Trump advisors is that while there are certainly some conversations as to what's next, they're not very grounded. They're not very serious. The RNC is not actively making preparations right now for Trump to potentially step out of the race. But I do think there's some growing concern among these down ballot races in battleground states like the ones we talked about earlier, that Trump's poor performance at the top of the Senate could possibly make control of the Senate at risk.
Rick, are you hearing anything there? And also, we're talking about Trump and Clinton, but Johnson is coming up in the polls and Stein is coming up a little bit as well.
Yeah, and these things are all connected. And it's as you start to see some Senate races and House races come onto the board and the drag effect that it looks like Trump may have across the ticket in battleground states, that's when you see more Republicans come out and put more distance between themselves. And I agree. I think typically with third-party candidates, we tend to pay less attention as an election gets nearer because the choices are clarified. I think in this case, and we have a new independent candidate just on the board from the Republican side, the conservative side coming in this week, I think that these guys will become more relevant. Because people are clearly disaffected and disenchanted with the choices.
Well, I think if we have more topical speeches like they've given, I mean, people can look and see. One person wants to dismantle, you know, take away regulations, things like the EPA's water programs. Another wants to, you know, build infrastructure. I mean, there is a choice. There are things to listen to and talk about.
Well, and in fairness, in this case, they both are proposing big infrastructure programs.
Right.
In fact, Donald Trump has said that his is like double Hillary's.
Huge.
I don't know how – it's huge.
Bigler.
Rick Klein, political director at ABC News, and Juana Summers at CNN, politics editor. Thanks so much to both of you.
Hey, thank you.
Thanks.
There is a tie for gold. Manuel got in there first indeed, but she tied the 16-year-old.
Sound from NBC yesterday of Simone Manuel tying for gold in the women's 100-meter freestyle, the first African-American woman to win an individual swimming event. The commentators were saying this was going to mean so much for swimming and African-Americans in the United States, an historic event. But soon, social media was aflame because NBC didn't play her medal ceremony live. They waited an hour. Let's look at that and other Olympic stories that are trending online with Femi Okeh, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. Femi, what were people saying about this?
What could be more important than this historic event of an African-American woman getting an individual gold medal in swimming? That is really important. But what was NBC showing while she was getting her medal? They were showing repeats of Russian gymnasts. I love Russian gymnasts, but I would have loved to have seen that live. The internet went apoplectic and then started to post little videos of Simone's medal ceremony, and there was places where you could actually watch it. And then eventually, 1 hour later, NBC caught up and then showed her medal ceremony.
Well, what is NBC saying?
Well, they are time shifting to try and get the most audience at peak time. So this isn't the first time this happened. Were you watching the opening ceremony?
Yeah.
Where I was watching on an international feed because NBC's feed was an hour after everybody else's.
Right.
So they're really trying to get peak ratings for this Olympics.
Right, so what happened there with social media is the tweets were coming out saying, wow, look at this. That is incredible. And you're looking and you're thinking, no, it's not.
Yep.
Because people were tweeting live. Right.
What are you seeing different? Let me tell you the reason why this is so important, not just because of the swimming event and mm-hmm. the sporting achievement. It is because if you look on the USASwimming.org site in the United States, 60 to 70% of African Americans and Hispanic kids do not know how to swim.
Right.
It is a well-known statistic. They don't know how to swim. African-Americans, Hispanics, people of color don't swim as much as the white population in the United States. So having amazing role models in the Olympic pool who are black, who are female, it's so important for the youngsters growing up right now. That is really, really important. And one of the things that happens with Simone is that she's often asked about being a black swimmer. All of the time. And she said to reporters as the lead up to her event is, I would like to be known just one day as Simone Manuel. Full stop.
Well, I have a couple thoughts there. We've done stories on the concern about African-Americans not swimming. And there's a deep-seated generational fear of water on the part of many African-Americans because of being forced to flee in water from people trying to hang you and things like that. So that's what we're talking about, not the fact that they can't or won't. So
yes, there were lots of stereotypes about, well, black people don't swim. Black people run. I was like, I'm a black person. I swim. And I'm a really terrible runner.
And so does Simone Manuel, and we didn't see her medal thing. And also, she said some things after her medal ceremony in a USA Today interview. First of all, tell us about that. And I'm wondering if maybe some people, thought she might say. I'm wondering if there's some political overtones. Tell us what she was saying.
This is what Simone said. She says, it means a lot with what is going on in the world today. Some of the issues of police brutality. This win hopefully brings hope and change to some of the issues going on. It was quite general. but you know that she's talking about race in the United States, which is a hot topic right now.
Right.
And she just talks about often being asked about her blackness, being a black swimmer, and she says, my color just comes with the territory.
Yeah. Well, there's that story. We encourage people to look into that. But there was also a lot of outrage online over Daily Beast's story yesterday that's since been retracted. Tell us what happened here.
Goodness me. Yes, Nico Hines is the London editor of the Daily Beast, and he decided to write a story called The Other Olympic Sport in Rio, Swiping. And his story was about gay athletes in Rio, and he decided to pose as a gay man. He's a straight man. He decided to pose as a gay man to see how many athletes would respond to him.
On the gay social network.
Absolutely,
yeah.
So there's an app called Grindr, which is an app for men who like men who can find them very easily. So think about Tinder, but just specifically designed for bisexual and gay men. So that's what he was using as an app, and he found a number of Olympic athletes. Now, he didn't name them, but he did give out enough information where some of the athletes were, well, if you knew our sport and if you knew our form, then you could probably identify.
Well, and so what are some of the things people have said online? I'm holding Amini Fanua. He's the swimmer.
Oh, my goodness.
He's outwardly gay, but he said, boy, there are people who come from countries where they will be killed.
He's a Tongan athlete, and homosexuality in Tonga is a major issue for most of the community, most of the society. It is frowned upon. Many places where it is illegal to be gay, these athletes have effectively been outed. I want you to have a look at, if you're on Twitter, have a look at Amini Fanua's Twitter feed, and you will see his argument for why this was irresponsible journalism.
Right. And besides, you wonder, well, wait a minute, what if somebody went undercover and found out how many straight athletes were going on dating websites? It would just be appalling. So there's that story. But we want to touch on another one before we let you go. By the way, I want to underscore that the Daily Beast has since apologized for their investigative report on Olympians on a gay social network website.
And if you click on it, you won't find it anymore.
There.
You will just find the apology.
They've retracted the article. But here's another story we want to make sure we get to. You've noticed a lot of affection online for Chinese swimmer, I hope I'm doing this right, Fu Yuanhe. Tell us why.
She is stunning. She has a face that lights up the world. She has a fantastic smile. She's a pretty good swimmer. She swims for China. And she won a bronze medal for backstroke. Now, she started to go viral in China when the Chinese reporter came up to her and said, congratulations, your time was this time. And she was like, what? I thought I came fourth.
Let's listen.
A bronze medal.
Yeah, let's listen. Yeah.
Yes.
You can hear that. The inhale.
What?
Yeah. And she just has a huge smile. And so she's gone viral.
Huge smile. She's gone viral for that reaction. And then she is having so much fun in Rio. Her face, her smiles, her reactions. She's bounding around. She is a giveable, wonderful athlete. So there are gifts of her, little moments of her joy, her expression. And she's one of the most fun athletes to be following right now in Rio because her joy is expressed through all of the online people following her.
Femi Oke, host of the stream on Al Jazeera English. We will hook you up to everything we've talked about. You can just smile as you watch it. Femi, thank you. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, Olympic track and field is underway in Rio. One of the signature events will be the marathon, the grueling 26.2-mile test of speed and endurance. Here now is Alex Ashlock takes a look now at the men's and women's races.
When the topic is long-distance running, the first country that comes to mind is probably Kenya. So it might surprise you to know that only one Kenyan man has won an Olympic marathon. And no Kenyan woman has ever won gold. But in Rio, Kenyans should be right at the top of the pack. Helen Kiprop and Jemima Sumgong are among the talented African runners to watch in the women's race on Sunday morning, but there are also three Americans in the mix, including Shalane Flanagan. She's looking forward to running the Rio course.
It's great. It's very scenic. A lot of highlights of the city and some really beautiful buildings. We'll be running along the coastline, and so we'll get some good ocean breezes. And it's a beautiful country, so I'm pleased with it.
The men's Olympic marathon is next Sunday, August 21st, and the big favorite there is Kenyan Eliud Kipchoge. He just missed a world record when he won April's London Marathon.
That is the second fastest marathon of all time. Believe me, that's not just a first place. That is a moment of marathon history.
American Galen Rupp will try to make his own history in Rio. He's going for a double, running the 10,000-meter race tomorrow night and the marathon just a week later. Only one runner has ever won both races at the same Olympic Games. Rupp has tons of 10K experience, but he's only run one marathon. That was in the Olympic trials in February, and he won that race.
It's a tremendous honor to be able to represent your country in Olympic Games, so I'm just thrilled that I was able to, you know, to cross the line in first. It was definitely difficult out there. There were a lot of great competitors, and it was a tough race.
While Galen Rupp is a newbie to the marathon, his teammate Meb Keflezighi is a veteran. He's run more than 20. Keflezighi captured a silver medal at the Olympics in Athens in 2004, but Rio marks his swan song. He's 41 years old, and this will be his fourth and final Olympic appearance.
You know, a thrill of a lifetime, just like it was in Athens, just like it was in New York, just like it was like a Boston. I feel blessed.
Keflezighi is a past winner of the marathons in Boston and New York, and over the years, he's had a friendly competition with this runner.
The biggest thing that I think I hopefully left with my career was like the sense of we can run with these guys and we should try.
That's Ryan Hall, forced to retire this year because of health issues. But before he stepped off the roads, he did help put American distance running back on the world stage.
Oftentimes people look over on the starting line, they see other African runners and they're like, I'm not even going to try, you know? But that's the first step, is going for it, putting yourself in it. And I think that's what we'll see in Rio with our Olympic team. Like, they're going to stick their nose in it.
And we'll see how that goes starting Sunday morning when the women set off on their marathon journey on the streets of Rio. For Here and Now, I'm Alex Ashlock.
Support for Here and Now and the following message comes from Blue Apron, helping you make delicious home-cooked meals by sourcing from a community of artisanal suppliers, family-run farms, fisheries, and ranchers. Whether it's ramen noodles, wild-caught Alaskan salmon, or heirloom tomatoes, you choose from a range of recipes that can be prepared in 40 minutes or less. Pre-measured ingredients delivered to your door only when you want. Check out this week's menu and get 3 meals free with free shipping at Blue Apron. blueapron.com/here. New recipes are created each week. That's blueapron.com/here.
The wildfire that has been burning in San Bernardino County outside of Los Angeles is now 80% contained after a massive effort by firefighters, including those with special training called hotshots. Annie Gilbertson of KPCC spent the day with families waiting for their hotshots to return home.
Rachel Powers darts across the living room in her Los Angeles home and produces a glossy photo book.
At the end of the fire season, Anthony likes to give gifts, so we made a hotshot book.
Hard hats, hand tools, bulldozers. Her husband Anthony's hotshot crew has everything but pictures of actual fire.
But obviously not, because when they're near the fire, they're working really hard and they don't have time to take photos.
The schedule is grueling. 14 days on, 2 days off, and even that's not guaranteed.
16-hour days, they get 8 hours of sleep, and that's it. And he sleeps in the dirt.
The work can be dangerous. A few years back, Powers got a call from her husband.
And he said, babe, I'm okay. I just got a little scratch. I'm in the hospital, but I'm okay. My heart dropped.
A fallen tree tore off part of his ear and left him with a big scar on the back of his head. About a month later, he went back to fighting fires. But she still worries.
Who wouldn't get worried if their husband was police officers, firefighters? I mean, doing any dangerous job, who wouldn't get worried?
A stressful fire season is often made easier by tight bonds formed by hotshot families. I said goodbye to Powers and headed to the home of their close friends, the Davidsons. Zee Davidson greeted me at her door in nearby Santa Clarita. Davidson is one of the few female hotshots, so she knows what it's like on the front lines. She fought fires for 7 years, often alongside Matthew Davidson. At first, he didn't like it.
He actually tried getting me fired.
But she proved she was tough. And amid fallen trees, they fell for each other. After they married, Davidson found herself facing a choice: firefighting or family.
It's not realistic to be a mother on a hotshot crew. It's not, you know, and to have both parents gone all the time.
Her son is now a year and a half, and Davidson is sitting out this fire season on maternity leave. The baby's learning dad's in the phone.
Every time the phone rings, he says dad. Well, it's like being a single mom.
Yet all the families I spoke to described deep respect for the demanding profession. When I called Trish Houston, she was at the Forest Service compound in the mountains of San Diego County. Her father was a firefighter and her grandfather. Then she married one. Last month, when Houston heard the sand fire in the Angeles National Forest was growing, she guessed it wouldn't be long until her husband, Jim, got called out again.
They had gotten released from the other fire, came home. Of course, my daughter was just jumping all over him, so excited to see Daddy.
Sure enough, he got the call.
And so that was kind of a bummer because it was like, oh, man, we were going to barbecue steaks tonight.
The steaks went into the freezer. In 20 years of marriage, she can't count the number of fires that put their lives on hold. She hoped her husband could finally come home for a break.
Yeah, and I don't even tell my kids, oh, Daddy's coming home from the fire, because a lot can happen between getting released from the fire and actually making it home.
A lot did happen. Jim Houston got a call to fight the Sabranes fire in Big Sur. Those steaks in the freezer had to wait again. For Here and Now, I'm Annie Gilbertson in Los Angeles.
So Donald Trump now says he was being sarcastic when he made the false claim that President Obama was the founder of ISIS. He doubled down on the claim for several days, but this morning he tweeted out, "They don't get sarcasm?" Well, perhaps he was responding to the chorus of voices saying that while how President Obama has handled ISIS can be debated, ISIS started before Obama was even president. Let's get a look at that history and some of what lies ahead for the next president with Ben Watson, news editor for Defense One, the website that focuses on national security issues. He joins us from Washington. Ben, welcome.
Hey, great to be here, Robin.
And good to talk to you. And when you heard Donald Trump say President Obama and Hillary Clinton, but Obama particularly founded ISIS, what did you think?
At this point, it's not a surprise in the campaign to hear these stretches or fabrications. There's a million different ways to kind of describe them, but the bottom line is it was not literally true.
Well, what is true? When did ISIS start? Take us through.
So ISIS, as we know it, started around 2006 when its predecessor group, Al-Qaeda in Iraq, headed by a man named Abu Musab Zarqawi, was killed. And 5 days later, the remaining Al-Qaeda and ISIS fighters renamed the group the Islamic State in Iraq. And it was 4 years after that, when their leader again was killed in a U.S. raid, that the current leader of ISIS, al-Baghdadi, took over.
We know that there's been a split in the Muslim world for centuries between the Sunni and the Shia Muslims. So the underpinning upset goes back centuries. But is it true, as some analysts have said, Lina Khatib, for instance, Carnegie Middle East Center, that the beginning of all of this really was, post the invasion of Iraq, the de-Baathization, the dismantling of the military, and many of those military leaders then went and formed some of these groups or participated in them?
There's a well-respected Middle East scholar, Charles Lister, of the Middle East Institute, who backs that up with some pretty thorough documentation in his book, his recent book, The Syrian Jihad. Saddam Hussein, before the invasion, was trying to contain the Sunni unrest in his country by sending some of his officers into mosques and into Sunni territory to kind of foment unrest. Well, the consequence of that was that a lot of these officers wound up becoming more wrapped up in the broader Sunni struggle against Shia and against non-Sunnis and non-Muslims. And whenever Saddam fell, of course, the military was disbanded. And a lot of these people kept up their fight that they had been charged for even before the invasion. Many of them went over and joined Zarqawi's al-Qaeda project.
Well, what about another claim that President Obama created a vacuum when he drew down the troops in Iraq? Now, we should say this was a George W. Bush timeline that was then implemented by Obama. After Iraq wouldn't agree to give U.S. troops who were in Iraq essentially immunity in civil cases, but is that now seen as a mistake, that troop drawdown?
I wouldn't characterize it as a mistake because we followed the recommendations of the democracy, such as it was, that we had installed in Iraq. And so for that reason, you can't go in to a country saying that you're going to install a democracy and then a democracy doesn't really want to give you the certain protections you need to keep your troops there. You know, then you become kind of a dictator advocate in a way, pushing aside the very cause you said you were coming to the country for.
What about the way the Obama administration has handled ISIS in Syria, elsewhere?
It seems to be in line with President Obama's broader intent when he had come into office in 2008 to wind down these wars. And so it's consistent with his light footprint approach to some of these wars where you had a lot of American soldiers getting into harm's way in combat and coming over, you know, to Dover Air Force Base in a casket. And he got tired of seeing that. A lot of the American public did, too. And so what's the kind of counter proposal to having a lot of ground forces? It's going over and it's advising and training and allowing these local nations' militaries to handle the fight themselves. Now, when you pan over to Syria, what do you do about the Assad regime, which has perpetuated all of this violence since 2011? And really, even before that, fomented its own insurgency and Sunni kind of tensions within the country. Well before that, they were documented as sending some extremists to Iraq in the early stages of the Iraq invasion. So he has a long history of trying to co-opt an insurgency to his ends and kind of keep him as the best bad option in Syria. And that's sort of what the U.S. is working with overall, is a lot of as much as it can pull together, the best bad options.
Well, and you mentioned President Obama's light touch. That's one of the criticisms of a candidate Donald Trump. He just wants to bomb the heck out of everything. And we didn't mention drone strikes, which are, you know, a big part of the Obama administration plan. The Pentagon just recently detailing how many drone strikes there have been and under what situation they should be used. So we're going to put aside that political debate about how to go forward in Syria. What is a new president facing? President Obama, speaking at the Pentagon last week, ticked off a long list of recent terrorist attacks. Let's listen.
We've seen terrible bombings in Iraq and in Jordan and Lebanon, Saudi Arabia, Yemen, and Afghanistan. Attacks on an Istanbul airport, a restaurant in Bangladesh, Bastille Day celebrations at a church in France, and a music festival in Germany.
Well, Ben Watson, just in hearing that list, you're reminded, too, you can't bomb the heck out of all of those places to stop, you know, the bombings that are there. I just remind you that this isn't just contained in one place, obviously something that we know. But where is the U.S. fighting wars?
The U.S. is fighting wars in terms of dropping bombs in about seven countries. And it began in Afghanistan and Pakistan after the 9/11 attacks, when we were pursuing al-Qaeda and we were pursuing the Taliban, who had harbored al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. Now, beyond that, it in less than a year, it went over and shifted over to Yemen, where we took out some al-Qaeda fighters there in the first drone strike there in 2002. And then over to Iraq, of course, with the precursors to ISIS. On to Somalia, Libya, and now Syria. Those are the ones that are cited for the 2001 authorization for the use of military force that initially started America's response to the 9/11 attacks. So seven countries where we're bombing and many more that we have an eye on.
And how many ISIS fighters do analysts think there are?
The latest count that I've seen is upwards of 25,000, the lower end being 19,000. The numbers on this stuff are really shifty, and even to use U.S. commander's words from, I think, 2 days ago, he called the numbers game really squishy.
But even if you double the guessed number of 25,000, even if you doubled that, not even a fraction of the soldiers in conventional war. Is there a time, can you think of a time historically, a military situation, where it's been this dispersed, it's been this... You know, the phrase that came up after Iraq was whack-a-mole.
I can't think of a time when it's been quite this dispersed. That's sort of the overarching difficulty here, and of course the difficulty pinning down the administration to using the 2001 authorization, which 15 years later they're still using across another half dozen countries. It's an interesting phenomenon that's made all the more difficult by the internet, by social media, and by globalization kind of broadly. The way that everyone is becoming more interconnected and the way that money can be transferred, the way that the whole game of messaging is played and carried out.
So, you know, you speak to all analysts, you aggregate information. What's the thinking about the one thing that has to happen, what the one thing a new president has to do in order to either stem this or contain it, or what's the conventional thinking?
Well, it's nice to think that there could be a one thing, but it's a networked, it's a broad and all-encompassing deal that, of course, the military facet is only one component of. It's only one side of this whole game that involves largely, maybe more than anything, an inclusive kind of governance model, one that will take, you know, the frustrations that led to the rise of what we now know as ISIS after 2011. It was a lot of sectarianism and a lot of Sunni repression in the state of in the country of Iraq. Now, if you're able to kind of find ways to get representative governments that include these people's complaints and incorporate them into solid action where the complaints do not turn into violence, it really, from what I understand, it's inclusive governance. If you're looking for one particular thing. That's easier said than done. I mean, look at, you know, everybody would say, look at America. It took a long time for us to sort of, insofar as we're able to, get on our feet. And so to expect these folks to kind of come to is kind of fast food thinking. Mm-hmm. And, of course, it's not going to happen probably for many, many years.
That's Ben Watson, news editor for Defense One. We'll link you to his reporting at hearandnow.org. Ben, thank you as always.
Thanks a lot, Robin. I appreciate it.
A JetBlue flight from Boston to Sacramento hit severe turbulence last night. 24 people were sent to the hospital, including two flight attendants. People on board said fellow passengers who weren't wearing their seatbelts were ejected from their seats. The flight had to be diverted to Rapid City, South Dakota. Joining us now via Skype is Mark Weiss. He's a former pilot for American Airlines and CEO of Weiss Consulting Group. Mark, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
And turbulence is common on flights, but this sounds pretty extreme. 24 people sent to the hospital.
Well, yeah, it is. And, you know, turbulence is a common phenomena. You know, certainly this was one that caused a lot of injuries, and that's quite a pity. There are ways to mitigate that.
And what are those ways?
Typically, you know, when you get a flight plan, it may indicate on the flight plan if there are any known areas of turbulence. And you certainly try to minimize that or avoid that by either changing a flight path or an altitude. Certainly, the other way you get that is through when you're flying is through the air traffic control will notify you if there's any known turbulence in the area. And also you'll be notified typically by other aircraft in the vicinity that they're experiencing a certain level of turbulence, or certainly if you don't hear anything, you wouldn't expect it. This seems like it may have come out of the blue, so to speak, no pun intended.
But there was a front moving across the country, and there was a weather warning about that. Would that not have been enough to get the pilot to divert or to change altitude?
Well, you know, weather fronts occur constantly. I mean, you're always going back and forth through them. Certainly no pilot is going to be flight planned through or knowingly go through an area of severe turbulence. You're not allowed to do that. And in that case, yes, they would have been rerouted or a different altitude or a different path taken. But that didn't seem to be the case in this situation.
Is the physical plane in any danger from turbulence, even this kind of turbulence? Could the plane fall apart?
Well, think of this. I mean, there have been so many incidents of turbulence over the years. I mean, in the context of everything, very few aircraft run into a situation like this. But there have been enough to document the airworthiness of an aircraft. No aircraft has been brought down by turbulence. Just as an example, years ago when the early jets were made, the 707, and we've certainly progressed with the quality of material and the technology invested in aircraft to make them even stronger. But when you see a wing flex, you say, oh my goodness, that's going to break or come off. But wings were made to flex originally 32 feet. That's quite a bit. So, you know, the engines aren't going to fall off the mounts. The wing isn't going to come apart. It's very disturbing and it's very uncomfortable. But, you know, there's a difference between being unsafe and uncomfortable. Typically, you know, when you fly, you'll hear that the pilot will say, we recommend that you keep your seatbelt fastened at all times.
Right.
And there's a reason for that, because you get a phenomenon like this where you may come across a jet stream, which isn't very big or very wide or thick, but you may run into that and find yourself in severe turbulence very quickly, So when somebody says to you, keep your seatbelt fastened, there's a reason for it. And I'm pretty sure that the majority of people who have been injured in turbulence accidents on board commercial airliners were people who were not belted in at the time that they were injured.
But you said a moment ago, no plane has ever been brought down by turbulence. Is that right?
Well, in recent times, that's absolutely true. There have been some phenomena years ago in the earlier jets where there have been some questions about that. But, you know, today's aircraft, the ones that you're flying today, the way they're built, they're absolutely robust and remarkable machines. You know, I flew for a major airline for more than 20 years. I've been through severe turbulence. The one thing I always had confidence in was the structure of the aircraft.
And how far is it falling when there is severe turbulence? Because it feels like a lot, but is it actually that much?
It really depends. I mean, we've had aircraft fall, you know, a few thousand feet. And sometimes it's just, you know, very, very choppy. And you know, severe turbulence, there are definitions from the FAA on what constitutes severe turbulence, chop. There's various definitions. But it's when you lose control of the aircraft, even for a few moments. But remember that air is a fluid. And when you go through that, you're going to be going through different layers. So, you know, to be able to get out of this, either changing altitudes, changing a course, really will, you know, minimize the level of time that you're in this.
And the bottom line for the passenger is wear your seatbelt.
Absolutely. Passengers, crew, if they're not performing a duty in the cabin, need to wear their seatbelts. In the cockpit, we wore the seatbelts constantly, all the time.
That's Mark Weiss, a former pilot with American Airlines and now the CEO of Weiss Consulting Group, talking with us about turbulence after a JetBlue flight last night hit some severe turbulence. 24 people sent to the hospital after that. Mark, thank you.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.